You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for spending some of your time with us. We thought it would be the perfect time to talk about growing healthy vegetables. Our guest today is Sally Morgan. She is the editor of Soil Association's Organic Farming magazine. She writes regularly for other gardening magazines and is a member of the Garden Media Guild. Her new book is called The Healthy Vegetable Garden, A Natural and Chemical-Free Approach to Soil, Biodiversity, and Managing Pests and Diseases. Are you having problems with your vegetable garden? Well, what questions do you have about developing healthy soil? We'd like to hear from you. Join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Sally, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's lovely to be with you from the other side of the Atlantic.
Exactly. So you're in southwestern England, and I have to ask, I know you have been going through a heat wave. How is that affecting you and your garden?
Yes, we've had 2 weeks of very high temperatures, and on Monday we had a record-breaking 40-plus centigrade in the country. So that was interesting times. I've been mulching and watering like mad to try and keep the plants alive, particularly those which are quite susceptible to dry conditions, some of my squash, for example. But just this afternoon, the drought's broken, and we've had torrential rain. So we've probably had a couple of inches of rain.
Phew. And just to remind people, and you said 40 Celsius, it's actually about 104 Fahrenheit. So for us here in the States, so you can relate a little bit better. That's hot. Very hot. Because you're not used to that over there, right? I mean, that's ridiculously warm for you.
Yeah, that's once in a lifetime temperature. But we've had this across Europe this week as well. But normally at this time of year, mid-July, we'd be looking at 70s, low 70s, possibly 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So yeah, considerably hotter than what we've been used to.
For sure. Now, some of your gardening methods, or in fact, most of your gardening methods probably help you with the extreme weather, don't they?
Yes, I think by keeping my soil as healthy as I can and having lots of organic matter and lots of mulching, I've put my soil in the best shape to be resilient to drought as well as cold and wet. So anything that is going to be extreme, then you need good, healthy soil to start with.
Right. Well, that's a good segue into your book, of course. Now, we've all been hearing about organic gardening, of course, for some time now, but the terms like regenerative gardening, agroecology, permaculture, they're relatively new, at least to us here. Would you explain what those terms actually they mean?
Yeah, and then people are using them a lot at the moment. There's a lot of greenwashing going around as well. if we start with agroecology, which I think is the sort of the easiest one, it's really farming with nature. So you're making sure that when you farm on a large scale or a small scale, that you are looking after the wildlife, you're doing everything to encourage biodiversity, and you're not doing things that are going to harm the wildlife. And we have a lot of agroecology in this country. It doesn't have to be organic, only certified organic, but it's nature-friendly farming. When you take regenerative agriculture, it's really about building the soil. And over the last 70 years since Second World War, soils around the world have been degraded because we've been using a lot of artificial fertilizers, pesticides, and the soil has got less rich in life. It hasn't got as much organic matter present because we've been using artificial fertilizers rather than good old manure and natural products. And so the soil has actually got starved. And so regenerative farmers are looking to build the organic matter in their soil. And the other benefit of regenerative farming also is that it's mopping up a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and is a really important contributor to fighting climate change. And then the third one, permaculture, goes back quite a way. it comes back from Central Australia, Austria rather, and it's to do with growing in a way where you respect nature and you will work with nature and you try and mimic the way that nature does things. So you're looking at how you put things together, which plants go well together. Perhaps as an example, maybe a forest, a food forest where you've got layers and you are trying to mimic what goes on in a big forest, but on a much smaller scale in your own ground. And this is quite an exciting form of growing as well. So the three together are pretty powerful stuff.
For sure. And as far as organic gardening goes, I think a lot of us just define it as not using chemicals, but you go a little further than that, don't you?
Yeah, organics is a big topic. And obviously, being a certified organic farmer in the UK, we are looking more than just stopping the inputs. Obviously, that's a very important part, but we are at the foremost about our soil. Soil, whoever you are, whether you're a gardener, a grower or a farmer, soil is your most important asset that you have, so easily damaged and takes forever to recover. And organic farmers are looking after the soil. They are looking to natural cycles to replenish those nutrients that their crops need. And on top of that, we're not using pesticides, we're not using artificial fertilizers, but we're also very high level of animal welfare. And we are trying to do our best for the supply chain. So interestingly, organics is also about fair trade, not just about the method of growing.
Okay, great. And you do a wonderful job in your book explaining the basics of soil. What do you think every gardener should really know about their soil?
I think if you pick up any gardening textbook from the last 50 years, they all go on about sand, silt and clay and the oxygen and the water. But for me, the most important thing is soil life. Without soil life, you haven't got soil, as far as I'm concerned. And we know so little about the life that lives in the soil, and so much is there. And so I think that's the important thing for me, understanding what lives in the soil, the fungi, the bacteria, the protozoa, the worms and the beetles and the other organisms. And that is the most important thing. If you've got a healthy soil, you've got huge biodiversity in your soil as well. And that really puts you in a very good situation.
And you had mentioned a little earlier that using the fertilizers we've been using in the last decades or so is just not a good idea. Why don't you go into that a little bit more and explain why that is?
Yeah, inorganic fertilizers, I always describe as fast food. Ready-made food for plants. Plants love them, don't get me wrong. You put an artificial fertilizer, a granulated fertilizer with NPK present, and you'll get good plant growth. But the trouble is, in the soil, you've got so many microbes, and they are all busy doing something. And they take organic food, and they break it down into a form that the plants can use, the nitrates. And there's lots of them, and they all, it's like a factory conveyor belt. They've all got a specialist job in this amazing ecosystem. And they take that organic nitrogen, convert it to the form that the plants can use. And you start using artificial fertilizers, you put all those amazing artisan microbes out of work. So not surprisingly, they wander off. And then when you stop using that fertilizer, there's nothing there to provide the plants with food. And sadly, this is what a lot of our farmers around the world have got themselves into, this situation of relying on these artificial inputs and have got rid of all their natural life in their soil. So if they want to come off feeding these fertilizers, they've got to go through a sort of cold turkey situation. And then they're going to start rebuilding their soil, which comes from the regenerative side, so that the soils can once again feed the plants themselves.
So what are some of the best ways to regenerate your soil? Doesn't sound easy. It sounds time consuming.
Yeah, it's not a slow job. And every year it will get better. And so the best thing you can do is adding organic matter. And it could be in the form of your brilliant homemade composts. It could be something as simple as grass clippings. It could be a mulch of some form that you've got from leaves or whatever, but it's all organic stuff, and you're putting it on top of the soil and you're letting those microbes take it into the soil and to use it. And over time, the organic content of that soil will slowly increase. And we're not talking about huge percentages, just tiny percentages. But so much more carbon will be taken up when that happens. So I love to think that if all the gardeners everywhere were all regenerating their soils, they're all taking up more carbon and we're helping climate change as well. So it's not just about us as gardeners and our own personal spaces. It's about our community work that we're doing to benefit the whole globe. So yeah, building that soil is adding organic matter and then allowing those microbes to work on it and give you good, healthy plants.
Okay. And that is a very good point, because it is not just our yard, but it is the whole ecosystem. So we're talking with Sally Morgan. She is the author of The Healthy Vegetable Garden, a natural and chemical-free approach to soil, biodiversity, and managing pests and diseases. Well, we'd like you to join in the conversation. So give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or, of course, you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Our on-air producer today is Mackenzie Crummy, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us every Friday or listen again on Saturday mornings at 6. Or you can also go online and listen to us anytime. Coming up next week, we'll talk with Patty Nagai, and hope you can join us again. Right now, we are talking with Sally Morgan. If you have any questions, our lines are open, 800-642-1234. And Sally, we were talking a little bit about mulch before we went to the break. Now, over here in this area, we seem to like wood mulch the most. What are some of your favorites, and what do they do for the soil?
Well, actually, wood chips and wood mulch is a pretty good option, actually, because that is packed full of fungi, and that is really going to kickstart the soil life in your soil. So that's a big 10 out of 10 as far as I'm concerned. And I use a lot of wood chip in my own gardens. It's a waste product from local tree surgeons, so it's easily available and does a good job. I mentioned grass clippings, mowings, and things like that. I don't put them on straight onto the soil. What I tend to do is take the clippings and just spread them out so they dry off in the sun. So they're a bit like a sort of light hay, and I use that on pots. At this time of year, when we've had this heat wave and my pots were looking really quite sad, I got some wool, some sheep's fleece, because I've got a few sheep on the farm, and I put a thick layer of white fleece around the bottom, around the tops of the pots. And it's amazing. I've gone from watering those pots every day to watering them every other day. So that really did have a major effect. I was quite impressed. It doesn't look so great on the veg beds, all these little lumps of white everywhere. Uh-huh.
But I love that idea. That sounds great, because, I mean, it's an insulator. Obviously, we wear it when we're cold and keeps us warm, so it would keep the moisture in. I love it.
Yeah, and it's and I do put it around my cabbage plants as well when I transplant them. It just doesn't look great. The birds love it because they use it as best nesting material. And I need to find a farmer who's got brown, bleak coloured sheep. It looks so much better.
Yeah, there you go.
And it's free, you know. Yeah. Nobody wants fancy wool. So that's a really good free resource for me. But that aside, it could be a mulch, could be your own compost. Just sieve it down and just put a couple of centimetres, if that, around your plants. When I was in Hong Kong and it was very hot and humid there, I noticed they were using hay and straw as a mulch, and that was working really well for them. I don't know, do you get slugs?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we do. Okay. We do.
You have to be a little bit careful with mulch, because hay and straw is brilliant, particularly under strawberries and things, but it can bring the slugs and snails in, so you just have to be a little bit careful. And actually, the other things you can use are gravel. It doesn't have to be organic, although that's better for soil and building your soil. But if you haven't got anything else, then gravel or shingle or other aggregate would be quite good, because it creates this lovely layer over the soil. And so that works. And then if you're really desperate and you haven't got anything to mulch your soil and it's really hot, then actually weeds, when I pull my weeds up when I'm clearing the beds, I just drop them on the surface and they quickly frizzle up in the sun and create this lovely little mulching layer over the soil at no cost to me, because it's pick and drop. That's a very permaculture type thing.
I do that too, so I'm glad I'm not the only one.
I hate walking to the compost bin. I'm a very lazy gardener. So if I can pick it up and drop it and the sun takes care of it, it's perfect. So, yeah, anything organic within reason, you can mulch.
Okay. Well, we've got a couple of phone calls. So let's go to Nan in Madison. She's got an interesting question here. Hi, Nan.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I'm an author, and I'm writing a young adult novel that takes place on a farm. And the protagonist is a 14-year-old girl who's kind of going to partner with the local university to help, quote, save the farm by going more organic. And she can probably, for young adults, I could probably introduce maybe two concepts. And this would be in 2030, that would help the farm. What two concepts do you think would be good in 2030?
Ooh, interesting question. Sally?
I hate to say it, climate change is going to be well underway by 2030. I think by then we will be thinking hard about water. And water harvesting and saving as much water as possible. I think we'll also be thinking about resilience in our crops to be able to cope with the swings in this topsy-turvy climate that we're going to be experiencing potentially. So healthy soil is going to be critical then. So I would be recommending anybody looking ahead to start adding that organic matter to that soil to build it up, and so that the crops that they grow can have long, deep roots and be able to reach the water and to be able to cope with drought in the future. And so I think, yeah, we'd be planning for resilience and healthy soils, lots of water. Deep roots.
Deep roots. Excellent. Well, thank you for that question, Nan. And send us a copy of your book when it's finished. It sounds like something our listeners would like to hear about. Thank you again, Nan. And let's go to Loretta in Wausau. Hi, Loretta. What can we help you with?
Yeah, hi. I'm setting up some containers for growing cherry tomatoes, and I was thinking about making my own kind of potting mix. And I wondered if you had any recommendations. It's going to be cherry tomatoes. It's a little late, but the plants are somewhat mature that I'm going to be putting in.
Okay.
Hi, Loretta. You can make quite a lot of potting composts. I think for me, particularly when I'm potting on, I like to sort of make one that's a mix, and it depends what materials you have to hand at the moment. But I have a lot of leaf mould, which is composted leaves from last year. And leaves are brilliant material for compost, because they're light and airy and they hold water. And I would mix that in with some of my own compost that I've sieved. And I would also look for some loam, some topsoil, which has also been sieved. And I usually mix those three together in equal quantities. And then if I think the plants are going to need a little bit more in the way of drainage, then I might put a few handfuls of grit in, so that improves the drainage. And so we've got a balance there between leaf mould and a light, airy material, the compost that's going to be giving the nutrients to your plants, and the loam, which is going to give the structure to the compost so it doesn't collapse in the pot and it will hold the water. And those three elements, and you can tweak those to suit, a bit trial and error, really. But those three ingredients are very easy to find and quite cheap and pretty effective.
Okay, thank you for that question, Loretta. Sally, you said grit. I don't know if we're quite familiar with what you mean when you say that. Could you expand?
Yeah, sorry. So this is very fine rock. So it's bits of rock broken down. So it's like a gravel, but it's very much finer. So it's about 3 or 4 millimeters in diameter. Over here, we call it horticultural grits because it's stuff you put in pots to help drainage. So it's very, very fine gravel.
Okay.
But not so fine that it's going to clog up things. It's just enough to give it a little bit of sort of granularity when you
sure.
handle it.
Great. Thank you. If you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And let's go back to the phones. And Bruce in Eau Claire has a question. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering if Sally is familiar with Miracle-Gro, very common fertilizer used here in Wisconsin, around the country. Key components being nitrogen, phosphate, potash. I'm not sure. It probably doesn't qualify as organic, but I'm just wondering if you have any opinion as to whether it's helpful to the soil.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'm familiar, Bruce, with Miracle-Gro. We've got it over here as well. And actually, some of their lines do have Soil Association and other certification organic status. So they've obviously checked the ingredients. It's in a liquid form in some cases, and I think that's the one that we allow as organic. My personal feeling is with these types of products, and I know that Miracle-Gro is very well balanced, and you choose the one which is appropriate for the use that you want to put it to. I often wonder why we need, if we've got really good compost, why do we need to add more nutrients? And I think we have to remember that our soils are really quite rich in nutrients, and we don't need much in the way of fertilization. And I think horticulturalists over the years and textbooks and things always going on about performance, performance, performance. And sometimes it's better for the plant not to perform quite as well, but to grow healthier. So it's more resilient to pests and disease. And so I my personal feeling is I don't tend to buy those types of ingredients unless I've got a container and the plant can't reach its roots into the soil. And yeah, Miracle-Gro would be one that you can use. I don't know whether you have comfrey in the States. Do you have the plant comfrey?
Mm-hmm. Some people. Yeah. But yeah, we can grow it here.
You can make an amazing nutrient-rich tea from comfrey leaves or nettles or indeed weeds. You can put them in a bucket of water, let them rot down, and you get this stinky mess, which is full of nutrients. And then you can dilute that down 1 to 10 and put that on your plants. It's free, it's available, it gets rid of your weeds. And so while there's nothing wrong with Miracle-Gro and all the other products, I'm always looking for a more sustainable answer myself that is truly organic because it's come from my own plot. So I'm also thinking that's closed loop. That's my nutrients from my plot used back on my plants. And for me, I think that is the healthiest approach.
Yeah, I love that. I love that idea. Thank you, Bruce. Love that question too. Next up is Karen in La Crosse. Hi, Karen. Do you have a question for
Hello.
Us?
I do. I have a potted patio tomato, and it has blight on the end of the tomatoes. And I'm wondering what I can add to the soil to fight that blight.
Oh, common problem.
Yeah. Blight's a pig, isn't it? I would remove any blighted leaves straight away. That is a source of new fungi, so I would remove the blight from every leaf that you can see. The plant will look a little bit sad afterwards, and then I think you give it a good feed to really perk it up and let it produce new growth. In those cycle circumstances, probably And if it was in a container, I would probably use something like the Miracle Grow that we've just been talking about, or indeed a really good feed that you've made yourself from your compost or your weeds and things. And it just needs a really good organic feed that will boost it on its way. And then I think it is a finger question of crossing your fingers and hoping that the conditions favour your plant going forwards. But if the weather continues humid and favouring the fungi, then you're going to have to watch out for other infestations of the fungi, because the spores get absolutely everywhere. And so you need to be on alert and check them daily and remove anything that you see and be quite ruthless about that.
It's hard to do, isn't it, to pick off those leaves. Now, what should you do with the leaves once you take them off? How should they be disposed of?
Well, some people will say, oh, you must burn them. But actually, the fungus only lives on living tissue. So I would put them in the compost, but cover them over so that the spores can't blow off your compost. Or indeed, put them in a bucket of water and let them all rot down together.
That'll teach them. Thank you, Karen. Next up is Brooke in Eau Claire. Hi, Brooke.
Hi. In the spring, about as soon as the soil can be worked, it's like a good month or so before I plant, I till up all my oak leaves, not all of them, but I till them up in my garden plot. And I'm wondering if they're, and then in the summer, come like July 1st, I use oak leaves. I just put them, they're not composted or anything. I just take the oak leaves and I put them around my plants. Now, is there anything negative about doing that?
Absolutely no, Brooke. It's a pretty nice idea, actually. They're not going to do any harm. They will rot down. They will hold water for you. They will trap your moisture. So I think that's a perfectly good idea. And if you've got any over, then just let them rot down to provide you for your own composts the following year. But yeah, anything like that will be perfect. Good idea.
Right. We've talked about that in the past, where using the leaves is so important, then, you know, putting them on the curb and having them, you know, go to a landfill or wherever they go. So use them up. Thanks, Brooke. If you've got a question, give us a call. We have a few open lines right now, 800-642-1234. And Kent in Reedstown is next. Hi, Kent.
Oh, hi there. After reading the book Liquid Gold, I use diluted urine for fertilizer.
I've heard of that before. Have you, Sally?
Yeah, and absolutely. It's a good source of nitrogen. It's urea, obviously, that we'll need breaking down. And I hate to say it, but over here, some people recommend that you use that to keep foxes away from your backyard as well. So, but it's a free source of nitrogen.
Okay.
So absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Kent. Now, we were talking about pests and diseases a little bit before, but they're part of gardening, obviously. What are the best ways to control them? I know it's a broad question, but...
Yeah, huge question. I think the first angle of attack is to have healthy plants. So for me, I'm not too worried about the pests and diseases initially. I really want my plants to be fit and well, as it were. Interestingly, I don't want to give them too much in the way of nitrogen, because this creates a lush growth, which gardeners think, oh, that's great. The plant's growing really well, fast. But that lush growth is very vulnerable to pest and fungal attack, for example. So actually, you're not doing your plants a favour by giving them too much feed, because they just grow too fast. So I'm a pretty mean gardener. I like the plants to grow hard and resilient. And so that's my first line of attack, healthy plant. And then my second line of attack is having lots of predators. Because I'm aware that those pests and diseases, those organisms are actually food for something. And so I'm going to control them mostly by relying on natural processes to have lots of natural predators in my garden that are going to do the control for me. And I'm also going to live with a little degree of pest and disease. So the one exception probably is blight. I would pick my plant over to the nth degree to remove any sign of blight. And there's not much you can do to stop that. But for other things, I don't panic. So if I see something like lots of green fly or black fly over my broad beans, which is a problem over here, I don't panic. I just look for some ladybugs and I hope that they're going to come in soon and do the job for me. And often if I go back 2 weeks later, they're all gone because there were some larvae around that I didn't recognize munching them away. So I think my first line of defense is healthy plant and my second line of defense is lots of predators and hopefully...
And lots of patience. We need patience, too. Okay, great. Next up, we have Aram in Madison. Hi, Aram. What's your question?
Yeah, I this summer read a book called Braiding Sweetgrass, which was kind of written by an indigenous person who talked about kind of the connection between plants and the land. And I have begun using, as a result of reading that book, seaweed from the lakes around Madison to mulch my beds. And the problem I have run into is removing plastic material from that seaweed because it gets enmeshed in there. A, do I really need to worry about the plastic? And I'm looking for ideas about how to remove it so I can start using it on a bigger scale. Because when I called the Parks Department about the use of seaweed, they said that the seaweed that they scrape off the shores of the lakes, they put directly into a landfill, and it just seemed like a horrible waste to lose all that nitrogen and phosphorus into landfills when it could be used productively in horticulture. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks for
Thank you. Thank you. What a great option. I never thought about it. What do you think, Sally?
Oh, yeah, seaweeds. Brilliant stuff. I'm too far from the coast to make advantage of that, which is a great shame. But it has other benefits, not just those nutrients, but it also affects the plant growth itself because it's got chemicals which are very similar to plant growth hormones. And so seaweed feed in general is a really good option for plants. And a lot of the mixes we have over here have added seaweed, and I find they perform really well if I need them. So yeah, I totally get it. Free resource, washed up on the shores, going to be dumped. I mean, yes. But I'm so appalled by your comment about the plastic. I mean, what a shame. I must admit, I don't pick up much seaweed over here, so I've no idea whether the beaches along the English Channel have as much plastic, but I suspect if I was to start looking, I'd probably find a lot of plastic. And I know the plastics which really worry me are those little microplastics that you find in everything. And I don't know what the answer is, to be honest. I can see how you could cut out some of those plastics, but whether it's easier to let the seaweed mulch down on its own and just leave the plastic on the surface and then you can pull it off. I'm afraid I have no first-hand advice on that, I'm afraid, other than it's such a brilliant resource. And I really hope you can find a way to use it because it will be brilliant for your garden as a mulch and a fertilizer.
Definitely. What a great idea. And I think you need to experiment, Armin, because we need to know what you think. Plastic is such a problem for everything right now, unfortunately. And we have a email from Mike in Madison, and Mike is growing pole shell beans for the first time, and he wants to know if he should wait until the life cycle is done before harvesting, or should he sporadically pick the pods?
I think you get a better crop if you leave everything on the plant and let it go dry naturally, and then it's a bit shaky in the pods and things like that. At least that's how I collect my beans, the ones that I'm going to be harvesting for storage. You want them to be nice and dry, and if you don't leave them on long enough, then you're going to have to dry them off indoors and they have the risk of going moldy, etc. So, yeah, let the plant dry down. And that's quite a long wait. It's very frustrating to have to wait such a long time, and you have to hope that the little beasties in your garden don't find them first. But yeah, hang in there.
That's always an option. Thank you for that question, Mike. Let's go to Patty in Eden. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I just wanted to add to the tomato growing issues and the blight that happens. There's a lot of problems that people have with the blossom end rot, and if they would just keep an even soil moisture and not let it go too wet and not let it go too dry and mulch them as soon as they're planted, the tomatoes can take up the amounts of calcium they need to prevent the blossom end rot.
Great point.
Yeah, absolutely spot on. Totally great advice there. And I think this miswatering that people do put stress on the plant, and I think suspect that that makes them more vulnerable to disease. So keeping this lovely, even watering not only stops the blossom end rot, but I suspect it will help the plant resist blight as well, because it's well watered, it's not stressed. So great point. Thanks for raising that.
Thanks, Patty. Appreciate that. Our guest on Garden Talk today is Sally Morgan. She's the author of The Healthy Vegetable Garden, A Natural and Chemical-Free Approach to Soil, Biodiversity, and Managing Pests and Diseases. And you probably should have this book in your library. Join in with your questions. All open lines, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us on Monday when we talk about, we look at a more efficient and sustainable type of electric motor. And then at 11:45, the weather guys are back, and we're going to talk about heat waves. That's Monday on the Ideas Network. But right now, we're talking garden talk with our guest, Sally Morgan. And Sally, we've got a number of emails, and one just happened to talk about the lake weeds that we were talking about. It was Jennifer, and she's curious about using them for fertilizer because in Wisconsin we have PFAS pollution, PFAS, and Jennifer is wondering if this is an unsafe practice, particularly with vegetable gardens. Now, I'm not sure if you're familiar with those chemicals or not, Sally, PFAS?
I think, isn't that, yeah, I've heard them, and they are the organic ones that stay in the water for a long time, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that comes from the heavy industry around the lake in the past, from transformers and things like that. So that's a very good point. I suspect you'd have to refer to the authorities to see what the level of accumulation would be in the weeds, because I'm not sure whether they accumulate from the water or not. I know it accumulates as you go up the food chains. So whether it accumulates high enough to be unsafe to put on your vegetable or indeed on your soil generally, I'm not sure. So I think somebody's going to have to do a bit of digging and find out, I think, for us.
But, yeah, for sure. Jennifer, that's a great question.
Something to bear in mind, because we don't find that problem with marine life, of course. So
right. And maybe we can look into that and see if we can find an expert in the area and we can talk to them about it. Karen emailed and said she grows tomatoes in pots and wants to know more, wants to know what is a good way to stop blossom drop.
That's again back to your watering. I find, as well as a blossom end drop, which is the problem you get with a nasty rotten end tipped the tomato fruit, the fruits will drop off if they get a little bit dry. So the blossom will drop off. So what I've found in the last week in my very hot greenhouses is that when temperatures get so hot, the blossom does just shrivel up and dry. So what I've been doing is, and it's difficult because it's I'm spraying it off and misting it, trying to help and allow the pollen to move around. But I'm also minded at the same time that I'm creating conditions that the blight will like as well. So it's a tricky one. of that balance between making sure that the plant is well watered and the blossom doesn't shrivel up and not giving the blight fungus a bit of an advantage. So, but they're very susceptible to this, and it's not a huge amount that one can do effectively.
Okay, thank you. Sue in Waldo is up next. Hi, Sue.
Hi, I had a question about if you have any suggestions about how to deal with Japanese beetles on raspberry plants and also grapevines.
Do you have Japanese beetles in the UK, Sally?
No, we don't yet.
You're lucky.
I understand it's a real problem. And I'm afraid my answer, and I was talking to a horticulturalist who'd been to visit his daughter in Wyoming, and they've got it there badly as well. And he was going on about the fact that you get rid of one generation and then they just all fly back in again. So I'm afraid the only thing I will say is you might want to check up. And again, I'm not familiar, but in this country, we use a lot of predatory nematodes, microscopic nematodes from the soil. And a company over here has nematodes that will attack lots of common pests. And the nematode works by being taken up into the body of the pest, where it releases some bacteria, and the bacteria kill the pest. And it works on a lot of insect pests in this country, and particularly things which are causing us problems. So I don't know whether Japanese beetle might be susceptible to predatory nematodes, and you'd have to look at the chemical company, which is BASF, B-A-S-F, which I think is international. And maybe some type of treatment like that. Alternatively, the other thing I think about is that they're flying maybe pheromones and things to trap them in that respect. But I don't think I'm going to have any enlightening ideas, I'm afraid, with this type of pest.
Well, Sue, I can tell you we had an entomologist. Phil Pelletieri was with us on Wednesday. And of course, like every time he's with us, Japanese beetles come up. And there's a number of things people are trying. Nothing necessarily works great. But he did say that it looks like they're sort of in a cycle. So they will come in gradually. They'll become extremely populous and then they'll start going down. And he was saying that in his area right now, he hardly saw any this year, whereas a few years back, they were everywhere. So they do kind of, they're cyclical. So fingers crossed. Yeah, good luck. They're just not easy to deal with. So thank you, Sue, for bringing that up. Let's go to Don in Cottage Grove. Hi, Don.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
I've got a supply of oats that are surplus and a large vegetable garden. I wanted to know if I can use them as green manure. When to apply, when to turn them under.
Okay.
So was that oats? Did I hear oats?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, green manures you can use throughout the growing season. It's really dependent on the type of crop, whether there's enough time for them to grow. I'd have thought mid-season. At the moment, you've got plenty of time for them to germinate, cover that soil, and give you some really good protection. And then you can finish them off at the end, and that's going to give you some really great mulch, organic matter that you can either turn into your soil or let it. I just let it sit on the top as a thick mulch and let the soil life take over it. But if you've got some free supply, then yeah, it sounds good stuff. And that should be sown quite thickly, so it gets a really good cover.
And thank you, Don, for the question. Sally, explain a little bit about green fertilizer in case somebody listening is not quite sure what that is.
Yeah, so green cover crops are grown when you've got a spot on your beds. You're between crops, perhaps, and you don't want to leave that bed exposed to the soil, to the elements. You want to protect your soil. So you would sow this cover crop quite thickly as a temporary crop. You're not going to harvest it, and you're just going to let it grow to a point where you're either going to chop it down or turn it in. Or in my case, because I'm no dig, no till, I would chop it right down, and then I cover it with cardboard so it rots down on top of the soil, and then I can allow the worms to get at it and pull it into the soil. And there's lots of things you can grow. You can grow those which are good for insects, and that if you allow them to flower, you'll get lots of insects come in as well. They add bulk, they add biomass to your soil. They will draw up nutrients from deeper in your soil. But most importantly, it's this biomass, which is important. You're capturing carbon and then you're locking it up in your soil, and you're protecting your soil when you haven't got anything growing. So it's a win-win, really.
Yes, it is. Great. Next up, we have Carolyn in Madison with a question. Hi, Carolyn. What can we help you with?
Our neighborhood had we were blessed with fireflies last year, and a few more this year, it seems. And we want more in the future. And so we've been, we're curious about habitat for fireflies. We learned that their larvae spend a year or two eating slugs and worms and other soft-bodied things in the soil. And I'm beginning to wonder if they might even eat June beetle.
Japanese beetles.
Beetle larva.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Carolyn. Sally, what do you know about firefly larva?
If you're thinking it is like a chaffer beetle, then the larva is a great big, fat, white-bodied beastie in the soil with a brown head, and they will spend a number of months, if not years sometimes, in the soil where they could be eating your plants. They nip, they sort of basically munch through plant roots. So some of these beetles you probably don't want to encourage, and others you probably would want to encourage if they're going to be preying on beasts in your garden. So beetles is a huge group of insects, and they've all got slightly different life cycles and slightly different benefits as far as the garden is concerned. I'm not sure. I mean, in terms of encouraging them in the larvae, they often like undisturbed soil. So you often find them in lawns because they can get into the roots of the grass plants. If you want ground beetles, then you want lots of wood and organic matter and wood chips and things, and they love hiding in that. So it's really a question of what type of insect do you want to encourage, and find out a little bit about its life cycle and work on that. So I can't be more specific, I'm afraid, because I'm not familiar with that particular type of beetle.
Sure. And you probably, Carolyn, could just talk to PJ Leash at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he can help you out with those questions too. So he's right here in Madison. Thank you for that call. And let's go to Phil in Mount Horeb. Hi, Phil.
Hi. So my question centers around nutrition of plants in container gardens. My yard is covered with walnuts, and the jugulone in the soil has prevented me from gardening just about everything there. So I've gone to container gardens. They are 18 inches deep, about 14 square feet in area. And I'm wondering whether or not I'm going to suffer from a depletion of micronutrients and other nutrients in the soil. I can compost on the top of that, but I've got an ample source of tree, brush, leaves compost nearby that's free, and I thought I'd ask whether or not that kind of material is suitable for restoring the nutrients in these container gardens.
Okay. All right, Phil, I'm sorry to cut you off there. Sally, we've got about a minute and a half before news, so if you can address that, go right ahead.
Okay, so yeah, walnuts, roots, and all its antagonists, difficult situation. I think, yes, I mean, the best thing you can do is keep on adding organic material to the top of your soil in order to compensate for what's going on underneath. And what you describe would be a really good option. I can't guarantee it will work given the nature of walnut, but it's probably the best thing that I think you could probably be doing in the circumstances. Feed it from the top. Don't turn it in. Just keep on adding it to the top. And hopefully your soil gets deeper and deeper and further away from those little fine roots coming up from the walnut tree.
And watch out for squirrels burying the walnut, the walnuts in your beds, because I've had to deal with that myself. So not easy at all. Our guest today is Sally Morgan. She is the author of The Healthy Vegetable Garden, a natural and chemical-free approach to soil, biodiversity, and managing pests and diseases. Please stay with us. There's always more to come on the Ideas Network. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking about creating a healthier garden today. Our guest is Sally Morgan. She is the editor of Soil Association's Organic Farming Magazine. She writes regularly for other gardening magazines and is a member of the Garden Media Guild. Her book is called The Healthy Vegetable Garden, A Natural and Chemical-Free Approach to Soil, Biodiversity, and Managing Pests and Diseases. How are your vegetables doing this season? Do you need help with pests or disease? Join us by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Sally, we have a couple more emails that we'll go over. We have one from Jack in Gurnee, Illinois. He called and couldn't stay with us, but he says that he mulches, when he mulches, a white fungus grows, and he's wondering if and he says the fungus is hard, and he's wondering if he should get rid of the old mulch or loosen it up. Can this damage his plants, and how should he handle the fungus?
Mostly the fungi that you're going to get growing in your mulching materials will be quite friendly stuff. So when I rot down a wood chip on the surface of my soil, for example, I get lots of white threads, and then you'll get some fruiting bodies, the mushrooms and things appear. And they're usually perfectly, I wouldn't eat them, but they're perfectly safe for plants. So I wouldn't normally worry about white fungi like that. That's quite common in woody materials. And I never bother removing the old stuff. Just let it build up, creating those lovely layers over your soil, giving even more protection. Unless you felt that the mulch was actually stopping the water from permeating through the soil, then I wouldn't bother to disturb it. And if you did think it was creating a little bit of a barrier, then you could always use your fork and use a large fork and push it through and just wiggle it around a bit so you get a few holes, a bit like wormholes. And so that would allow the water to pass through.
That makes sense. Thank you very much for that email. If you've got a question, our lines are open, 800-642-1234. We did get another email from Mary Beth in Two Rivers. She wants to know when it's the best time to transplant asparagus. Is it in the spring or the fall? And she'd also like to know what the best practices are to prepare the asparagus bed.
So definitely the fall. You want to get the plant while they're dormant. And to be honest, any good supplier of asparagus crowns is not going to provide you with one at the wrong time of year. So it might even be towards late fall, early winter that you actually get them. And when you get them, they are large rooting structures in a sort of big circle. And what the best thing to do is when you dig out the trench to plant your crowns is you have a little mound that you put this plant over, the roots over within your trench. So it's still buried, but it's just got a lot of material underneath it, just to support those roots and to lift them up slightly so they don't get too waterlogged. And then lots of organic matter backed into the trench where you're digging them. And as I say, I just have this little mound of soil where I put this crown over, and it all come clear. When you get it out of the bag, it's all this sort of network of roots in a sort of like a plate almost. And so you can lay that out over your little mound of soil and then cover it over. And then you get these little mounds developing in your asparagus beds over a number of years. And the other thing with asparagus, and I hate to say it, you're going to have to be very patient, because you don't want to take any spears for a good couple of years, because the plant really needs to build its reserves up before you start harvesting. And so patience is called for.
It certainly is. Barbara in Milwaukee emailed and wants information on neem oil in vegetable gardens. Is it safe? And if it is, how should she use it?
It is an organic product from the neem tree. The only thing I will say about neem, and it is allowed in some organic systems, but not all, partly because we now discover that neem itself is actually quite potent, and it's not targeting particular pests. So it's an indiscriminate material. It might come from natural causes, but it can easily wipe out your bees, your ladybugs and things, and your good guys as well as the bad guys. So I always think of neem oil as being my very, very last ditch attempt. If something's really, maybe this is the Japanese beetles, one of those things that is my last resort, and I don't tend to use it if I can, you know, manage without it, because it is very potent and it is indiscriminate. So you've got to be so careful where you spray it. And what people don't realize is that maybe you can recognize the ladybug, but can you recognize the larva? And this is where a lot of gardeners fall down on. They recognize the adult and they think, oh, there's nothing around. It's quite safe to use this chemical. And then they don't know that there's lots of larvae there. And actually, they're destroying the next generation of their beneficial predator in their garden. So I would be very wary. Personally, I am very wary, because I think as soon as you start using these even these natural products, you're upsetting the balance in your garden, and it could be a step back rather than a step forward.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara. Talking about the insects, we kind of have a love-hate relationship with insects in our gardens. How do you attract the good ones, and how can you tell that they're the good ones?
I think, first of all, the easiest way to attract insects into your garden, hopefully mostly beneficial or non-harmful, is through floral diversity. I'm getting very nerd-like this year about my floral diversity in my garden, in my yard. And by this, I'm looking at different types of flowers with different types of structure. So some are tubular, some are open, and some are more complicated structures like snapdragons and sweet peas and things. The more different, the more the types of flowers you have in your garden, the more insects you can bring into your garden, including the bees and including the beneficial predatory ones. So they all have different requirements. They've all got different length of mouthpart, and they're going to be looking for a different type of flower. So the more flowers you can keep in your backyard, the better. You'll get more insects, and hopefully there'll be plenty of predators in there to control the ones that you don't particularly want many of. And then the other thing to bear in mind is, you know, during the year, to make sure that you've got early flowers in your yard, so that those early insects, when they arrive, and maybe we have an exceptionally warm spell early in the year, and the insects come out and they haven't got anything to feed. So if you can have flowers in your garden as early and as late in the season as possible, and as many different types of flowers, then you're going to be on the good way. And the other thing to bear in mind is that some of these flowers might be weeds. And I'm beginning to quite like weeds in my garden. when I do my survey of how many different types of flowers I've got in March, which is very early for us, beginning of the growing season, 50% of the flowers in my garden are weeds, but bees and beetles and ladybugs and things are visiting those flowers on those little weeds. So unless the weed is a really horrible one, actually I'm getting far more relaxed about having weeds in my vegetable plots, because they provide ground cover, they provide flowers, and they feed those little tiny low-growing predators that you want in your garden. So embrace the weeds, embrace the flowers, and control comes.
That's right. Make it easy for yourself. You don't have to weed as much. I'm all for that. Let's go back to the phone. We have got Roger in Grantsburg that has a question for you. Hi, Roger.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great. What can we help you with?
Well, I've had an issue here. I live up in Burnett County in Grantsburg. I farm, I've got like about 140 acres. I have noticed here, and we have a really bad infestation of ants. They're just everywhere. Everywhere you cut the hay field down, and you see just tons of ants, anthills everywhere. And the same thing with a garden. It's like, man, how do you keep them out of there, and what can you do? And are they counter-cyclical? They go, and then they're popular, and then they don't, and they die out, or... What can you do to get rid of them?
Okay. Thanks, Roger. Sally?
My number one pet hate this year. I have so many ants in my garden. I can't believe it. And I'm getting bitten by them as well. They are evil creatures. I've got a lot of red ants, and they're the formic ones, and they are horrible. I'm not sure I can help you on this. They don't like disturbance. Obviously, where I find in the yard, they're under things. So under bits of plastic, under containers, in my containers. And so if I keep moving things around and disturbing them and opening them up so that the birds can find them and the beetles can find them, that's one thing. But that's a very small scale. That's not going to help you over 140 acres. I'm not sure, I'm afraid, what you can do with ants. As I say, disturbance works, but I'm not going to suggest you get your plough out and you go and till it all and just to disturb the ants out there. It's probably conditions. And sadly, with climate change, we get these longer, drier periods that favour the ants. They like a lot of organic matter, so sometimes improving your soil can encourage them too. They have communities, they've got their roots around places, they're very clever, obviously, organism wise they're colonial. So I'm afraid I'm not much use to you today to help you, other than I do sympathize with your plight.
Yes, thank you, Roger, for that question. Again, you might want to check out PJ Leash at the Insect Diagnostic Lab here at UW-Madison, because he might have some things that will help you control them. So give him a call or an email, and he can give you a hand with that. And if you've got a question for Sally, give us a call. 800-642-1234. Our lines are open. That's 800-642-1234. Sally, tell us about rewilding. I thought that was a really interesting topic.
So we had a book written by a lady called Isabella Tree a few years ago on rewilding, and it was an estate in southern England where it wasn't working farming-wise. She had a dairy farm. It wasn't working. And so she basically stopped managing the land and let it go wild with a little bit of control. She took down her fences, changed her cattle. So she's got those which like grazing more extensively, and basically stopped the control. And so that is a big movement now. About rewilding. And so in the gardens, you can do the same as well in your yard. But it's not just sort of letting go and just letting things take over. There is a degree of control, despite the name. because you do need to make sure that you just don't get overrun with pernicious weeds and brambles and nettles. And the next thing you know, you've got this impenetrable mass in your yard and you can't get through. But rewilding around the edges, which is a bit like allowing the weeds to come, to not having so much control so that you're allowing things to have a bit more free form, to allow the garden to look a little bit more natural in its approach. So maybe layers. So having layers under your trees, rather like a forest. And that all helps nature come into your garden space and help your biodiversity. And increasingly farmers are doing this on a much larger scale where they're planting new woodlands and they're allowing natural regenerative processes to take place. So it's an exciting time. And if you fancy learning a little bit about rewilding, then Isabella's book, Rewild, is amazing. It's extraordinary to see how she can turn around quite a poorly diverse estate. So now that she runs wildlife safaris and things in her farm, and you can camp there. So if anybody comes over to the UK, get down to Neff Estate in Sussex and you can go camping and you can go on safaris. And lots of unusual and rare species are moving onto the rewilded land, which is really exciting. The biodiversity has zoomed up in the amount that's there. So taking the control off and allowing things to do it their own way has really improved the biodiversity of that part of the country. So it's an interesting thing that you could do in your own grow spaces.
Definitely. Yeah, and you talk a little bit about it in your book about doing things like that with lawn spaces, because we usually we have too much. How does one go about doing that?
You can just let go. I know some gardeners will be absolutely abhorrent about the fact that they don't want to get their mowers out. We have something over here called No Mow May.
We do too. So, I think we stole it from you guys, but
it's brilliant. I think it's an amazing concept. And in my boring lawn, I had 17 species of flower this year. Allowed to come through. So it helps biodiversity. It stops using all that fuel to power the equipment. But you don't have to let it all go. What the compromise might be is to cut the lawn in the bits that you use and need as roots through, maybe play areas for the children. And then you allow the longer bits around the edges, little transition zones to other areas of the garden. Or you can make lovely shapes in the lawn, which is great. You've got tall bits, short bits, medium length. And that is actually real permaculture. You've got lots of little micro habitats. It means you're supporting more animals in that one space. So it's really great that a lawn cut in three different regimes, for example, could support far more wildlife than it would be if it was cut short.
Definitely makes a difference. Yeah, for sure. Kelvin called. He couldn't stay with us, but he suggested for Roger, who had the ant problem, that Kelvin uses diatomaceous earth to get rid of the ants, and it worked for him. So there's a thought. So thank you for that, Kelvin. One of your chapters also is called Plant Defenses. Talk about ways that plants can defend themselves.
It's an amazing concept, and we're beginning to learn more about this. And it's interesting. So when I used to see a caterpillar on one of my cabbages, I would remove them straight away. But now I leave one or two, because the presence of that larva on that plant is going to tell the plant that something's happening. The nibbling is actually something the plant can detect, and it starts a chain reaction in the plant to produce chemicals which are less palatable to insects in a form of protection. And then through its roots and through its network of fungal hyphae in the soil, it can talk to all the other plants in the area as well. And so you get this communication network happening in the soil, so that the presence of one larva at the end, one plant, allows the early warning system to go through the whole lot, and they all start working. And so it's interesting, now we know so much about the fact that plants can adjust the amount of metabolites they are producing to give them more protective stuff like tannins, which are less appealing to insect predators that might come along and nibble on them. So this is working, and then there's more interactions. And we had one earlier in the sessions with the walnut. The walnut has antagonistic roots, basically, that stop other things growing in its own vicinity. It's a bit of a hog, really. It likes to grab everything to itself. And so it produces chemicals from its roots that stops other plants growing nearby. And you get this in lots of different plant interrelationships where they make space for themselves, but equally they might have intimate relationships with types of fungi that will allow them to get more nutrients, more water from the soil. And there's even fungi that will protect plants from predatory insects in the soil even. It's an absolutely phenomenal interest area for me. And it's not my research at all. This is stuff I'm just learning about. And if you're really into this is an entangled web Merlin Sheldrick land. If you want to learn more about fungi, then Merlin Sheldrake's book is absolutely phenomenal.
We talked with him a while ago. And so if anybody wants to hear it, he's wonderful. You can go to our website, which is WPR.org/Larry, and look and do a search for him. The book is so fantastic. And I don't know if you listen to the audiobook, Sally, but he reads it himself. So it's really interesting to listen to it also. Lots of information in there. So yeah, for sure.
Wow. No, I didn't know that.
Yes, it's very good. So in the next, we've got a couple of minutes here before we need to say goodbye, but if you could just give us someone right now listening who thinks their soil's not so great and really needs some help, what do you suggest that they do?
Personally, I wouldn't dig it. I would no-till. Leave it alone so that you get those fungal connections in your soil and the worms in place. And then I would feed the soil, not the plants. And so I'll give it lots of organic matter on the top as a big thick mulch so that then it becomes incorporated into your soil over a period of time. And it's not a quick thing. It's not a quick fix. But if you keep on mulching your soil with good organic matter, then that soil will slowly get better and better, and you will have something to be proud of, which will be lovely.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Sally. We really appreciate you being with us, and thank you for writing this book. It's wonderful, and hopefully we can have you back again sometime. So thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Sally Morgan. She is the author of The Healthy Vegetable Garden, A Natural and Chemical-Free Approach to Soil, Biodiversity, and Managing Pests and Diseases. Hope you can join us on Monday when we're going to talk about more efficient and sustainable types of electric motors, and then check in with the weather guys and see what's happening there. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well and enjoy your weekend.